Hello, everybody, and welcome to Kentucky Ag Matters, a podcast designed to inform and educate both producers and consumers about all matters affecting agriculture. On this week's show, we visit with Mr. Scott Hayes, president of the National Pork Producers Council. And as always, we'll wrap things up with this week's timely tip. Thanks so much for joining us. We hope you enjoy the show. Well, hello, everybody.
Hey, Jay.
Hey, Jay.
It is winter time, isn't it?
Oh, my gosh.
Yes.
Snow, ice, you name it. We've been having it the last couple of days here.
We only get a few weeks of real winter in our part of Kentucky, and we had it all Monday, I thought.
Yeah. Yeah. I've had enough already, to be honest with you.
Yeah. This morning, I was going to go out to my vehicle to get something out for the trade show today, and we opened that door, and that brisk air, it almost took your breath this morning.
Yeah. You know, I look at it differently, I guess. I don't mind the cold, and I, for the most part, don't mind the snow. I dislike the ice, but I would rather it be cold and the ground be froze, and I don't have any livestock at all, but thinking back to when I did hay that time of the year, you know, I'd rather the ground be froze and us have something solid underneath us to work with.
I'd be good with that.
We were all texting back and forth the other day, and David said something that we was talking about, as long as animals were in the dry. Talking about calving and whatnot, being dry, as you put it, is a game changer in this type of weather.
It is. Yeah, this cold. When we have the cold rains here, when it's about 30 degrees and it's kind of raining, 32 in that ballpark, and they're calving, is never a good thing. So, you know, hopefully next week we're going to get to find out. And that's what I always say about Kentucky. If you don't like the weather, hang out a day or two, and it'll change. And things probably that way in Missouri too. But anyway, yeah, we're at the Pork Producers Association annual meeting, and we have an opportunity to record with some folks here today, and we've got a really good guest here today, and I'll let Jay introduce him.
Yes, sir. Mr. Scott Hayes, welcome to the show. Good morning, sir.
Well, thank you. It's a privilege to be here.
Glad to have you. Why don't you just take a few minutes for those that may not be accustomed to you and talk a little bit about where you're from and your background, kind of how you come to the role that you're in today.
Well, sure. I'm from Northeast Missouri, so if I go travel with pork producers, I get accused of being from the South, but I won't claim to be from the South today because Kentuckians don't usually consider that. I'm fifth-generation pig farmer. I had the privilege of knowing my great-grandfather, my grandfather that were on the farm, my dad and uncles. Just a traditional, you know, family operation, diversified. My dad focused on pigs. They had some cows because in Missouri, you always have some ground that needs cattle on it. And my uncle is famous for saying, "Well, we'll get those old cows up and look at them once a year, whether we need to or not." So, and another saying was, "You can't afford to leave a hog shed long enough to look at an old cow." So, cattle were there to kind of clean things up. So I'm not a cowboy. I'm a pig guy. And when I came back to the operation in the late 80s, after a couple of years in the military, I actually partnered with my father-in-law, and he was finishing some pigs, so needed more income because another family involved. And so I brought sows to the farm. About 5 years later, got to really live my dream of farming and partnered with my dad and uncles to build a hog operation. You know, that was in 94. So, you know, that North Carolina style production was coming to the Midwest, and we were a part of that. So we started an operation, and I managed that and ran that. I guess we still have part of it. Went through a significant change in 2023. Woke up one morning and realized my partners, who are all a generation older than me, didn't have a desire to own pigs anymore. My wife and I have been married 36 years, blessed with six children. Three of them are back on the farm, come to the realization that they really didn't want to own pigs either. So I was the only one that wanted to own them.
And you got to want to own them.
Yeah, you got to. So my kids really enjoy pigs. They like raising pigs, like a lot of things about the pig business, just didn't want to own them. So we sold off most of our pig inventory. We're still raising pigs, but we're raising them for others. Okay. The model, the business model that my kids have put together is to be more nimble, more agile, you know, move where the industry's moving. Mm-hmm. You know, with the traditional farrow to finish operation, you're kind of got yourself in a small box, you know, especially with all the contractual relationships that mm-hmm. takes these days. So we're raising pigs in buildings we own. We're raising pigs in buildings we don't own. Mm-hmm. You know, managing facilities and pigs for other people. We're trucking pigs. My son's doing some hauling and then barn maintenance. So, like I said, just looking at the industry, what's the needs? Mm-hmm. How, you know, do we want to participate? How can we fill those needs? And right now, you know, hauling pigs, doing barn maintenance, managing some facilities for some folks that are retired that don't want to manage them anymore. Those are needs that we're able to fill and having a good time doing it.
Yeah. And you got to be able to do that in the swine industry for sure, is to be able to roll and maybe, you know, pivot and do something different, you know, to be able to make it.
Yeah, sure. There's challenges, you know, and obviously I don't want to ignore the challenge that the industry's gone through this year and still in. You know, my heart just breaks, you know, for folks that's been at it a long time and having to make tough decisions. You know, and the decision I made a year ago, if I was totally honest, that was a tough emotional decision, you know.
Absolutely.
The day to sell the pigs, it wasn't a pretty day. But, you know, but looking back, it's opened some doors and some opportunities. And there's life after pig ownership. I didn't know that. So, yeah, it's a big industry. It's a diverse industry. There's room for everybody. And I'll keep saying it, but, you know, if producers have a choice, consumers have a choice. Yeah. And that's what we got to have.
Yeah. Well, and I think in agriculture, we just have to be able to make changes and to – because consumers are a big part of a farming operation, and a farming operation is a big part of to consumers. And I think that we have to be able to change and make and adapt to changes if we're going to keep it be successful in farming and being innovative and creative about how to continue doing what you love to do, that you're, you know, with the legacy of your family in this business, you may not be doing it the same way, but you're still in the business. And I think that's the thing about agriculture that allows a lot of us to be able to do what we want to do. It may not be how we envision it at one time, but we're still able to be in that industry and be able to continue to do the work that we really want to do.
Sure. And that's, you know, I guess there's a rock bottom emotionally when you go through that. And that rock bottom for me was the day I realized that I hadn't failed.
Mm-hmm.
And really, I was doing the same thing that every generation before me had done. They were looking at that farm, looking at that asset and saying, how can this best provide for my family?
Mm-hmm.
And once that realization set in, then it got easier.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, you know, a lot of us don't step back and look at things like that until after the fact. But you're exactly right. You know, when I came into our farming operation, I was looking to how am I going to make it better? You know, where I can make a living off a part of this too? You know, and I think that was a great point for sure.
I do too, and I in agriculture, if you were raised in agriculture, I don't know that you can ever leave agriculture. I mean, because it's just, we may, like I said, we may do it a different way, we may change, but agriculture is still going to be a part of our lives most of the time. And I have a lot of respect for folks that have been able to make changes and be able to keep going even though it looks different. So
yeah, my wife grew up on a dairy farm. Of course, I come from horses and a beef cattle background, and she's fond of saying that we need a group that she'd like to call Farmers Anonymous for those of us that can't quit on our own. and I think there's a lot of truth to that, because David said he came into his farm wondering out how he was going to make it better. Scott, it sounds like you took a hard look at things and figured out, or tried to figure out, how you were going to make it make and just keep going. And you did that by changing directions. You had to meet the needs of a changing family who wanted to be involved, but sounds like they wanted to do things differently than maybe you and your father and grandfather had done for years before.
Yeah, certainly. It's, so a saying that I remember clear back to my grandfather was, you know, my best isn't good enough anymore. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we've all done it different generation to generation. And that's out of not only necessity, but because we want to do it better. And that's, you know, as a pig farmer, I'm so adamant that pig farmers need to make the decision on how we raise pigs. Because mm-hmm. that's what we get up every morning thinking about. How do we make the life better for the pig?
Yeah.
Something that's been ingrained in me my entire life is, if the pigs do well, we'll do well.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep.
And it's so true. And I know everybody that's in the pig business, especially now, you know, with what gone through in my lifetime, you mm-hmm. know, we've been through these challenges before. This one sure looks like it could be a real low point, you know, tougher yep. than the other two. But it's not for the faint of heart. You got to enjoy the pigs mm-hmm. and you've got to make their life better every day.
Yeah.
You know, speaking of that, is we're early in 2024 right now, and a lot of things have changed in the swine industry. Going forward, what do you see some of the biggest issues that the swine producer of today is going to face in the next year?
You know, hopefully we, you know, this market thing turns for us. You know, we've been at it here for several months. You know, we've seen a reduction in sows. But haven't seen the reduction so much in production, which, you know, tells you that we're taking those bottom producing sows out.
Mm-hmm.
But there's some bright spots coming. I think there's some bright spots in trade that are coming. The Europeans are making some very significant changes that are not good for pigs or pig producers, but it's going to open some opportunities for us. You know, and fortunately we're nearly the low cost producer in the world because mm-hmm. of our ability to raise grain. Mm-hmm. So there's opportunity for us. Challenges are, you know, we've got to convince the consumers that we're the experts mm-hmm. and that we know what we're doing. We care about what we're doing. And you know, basically what's happened the last 120 years in this country is people have decided to hire somebody else to raise their food.
Yeah.
And now they're so far removed from it, they forgot why they hired somebody else, I think. And now they want to come back and say, hey, I want my food raised this way, or I want right. this particular food, which is all a luxury. Mm-hmm. And we'll do our best to fill those needs, but some things are asking for just aren't the right things
yep.
for the animals, and we can't go there.
It goes back to consumer education. Mm-hmm. And that's something we talk about on this show that we try to do. We try to find that balance between consumer and producers.
Yep.
And that is a growing challenge. I think it's been a challenge for a long time, but I think it's only going to be a challenge that's going to get steeper over the next maybe 10 years or so.
It certainly looks that way because obviously we're getting farther and farther removed from the farm. You know, when I was young, you know, most people at least had a grandparent or somebody that came from a farm, and now, you know, we're another mm-hmm. generation or more away yeah. from that. So, as we get more affluent, we want more things, right? Look at the variety of food we have. Never in the history of the world have we had access to the variety of food. As cold and snowy and all that is as it is outside today, we can go get fresh fruits and vegetables.
That's right.
It's
mm-hmm.
right. really yeah. unbelievable if you take a yep. step back
That's
and look
true.
At it.
Yep. That yep. is very true.
Talk with us a little bit. I caught part of your talk and didn't get to listen in to this part of it. But, you know, one of the things that's out there that's coming along and coming down the pipe is this Proposition 12. And so explain to our listeners a little bit about Proposition 12 and where kind of you stand and the pork folks stand.
Yep, certainly. Proposition 12 is a ballot initiative that was on the ballot in California a few years back, and we fought that all the way up through the Supreme Court, and unfortunately, the Supreme Court said that it is a problem, but it's not our problem. It's Congress's problem. So the law is going into effect, and it basically, California sets standards on how pigs have to be raised. And not what's different about that is it doesn't just affect producers in California. They said pigs have to be raised a certain way for that meat to come into California. Mm-hmm. So it affects producers all across the country, and it's our real issue with it is it's not science based. You know, there's some square footage requirements that nobody can tell us where they came up with those, mm-hmm. and they just don't make sense. I, you know, somebody likened it. We was in a room this week, you know, 50, 60 people, and you know, and comfortable. We've all been in those kind of rooms, and they said, so if we passed a law that said this room has to be twice this big, are we any more comfortable? Are we any safer? You know, and the answer is no.
It's right. A relative thing.
Yeah, right. And that's basically what California has done for pigs. So it just adds cost. Mm-hmm. You know, in this, when we're talking about sustainability and carbon footprint, it makes that worse, right? We have to have larger buildings for the same number of pigs. So we have to have more heat. We have to have, you know, all those things. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, with just being able to protect sows, and this is where, you know, consumers don't understand, sows are bullies. They always have been, and mm-hmm. they always will be, and we understand that as producers. We're not able to protect sows the way that we know how to do in this situation. Now, we're figuring it out. You know, we're doing the best we can, but there's some, you know, there's problem sows and to the point that some of those may even have to be removed from the operation. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and then also, you know, our job is to have those females pregnant and mm-hmm. be producing pigs. So, you know, we're blending sows at the wrong time to maximize that. And I don't think it's the right way to raise pigs. We can raise mm-hmm. pigs in a group environment. And do it really, really well, but those requirements don't allow some of those things.
Yeah, I know when I worked at when I was in between career and college and everything. When I was in college, I actually worked at a swine operation, fair to finish. And the only time we mixed sows is right as they came out of the farrowing house, right before we bred them. And that was the time that we mixed them, and then we went to individual farrowing crates. And I mean individual gestation crates, I'm sorry. But I mean that was kind of the only time they were ever together. And it would get nasty, you know, but on the same token, that was the best way to take care of them, and then, you know, when to house them, and then as we moved into the gestation crates. So
yeah, you know, individual treatment of sows is what I've always thought's best. You know, and technology is allowing some of that mm-hmm. in these, you know, in these group housing. And like I said, we'll get better. We'll do the best we can. Yeah. It's just frustrating that we've got folks that really don't know much yeah. about. They're not experts. They're not veterinarians. They're not animal behaviorists. They're just folks that have a different profession that think they know what's right. best, and right. it's not all the Hollywood crowd, but it's some of the funding comes from there, and yep. and it frustrates me that in this country that are so many times our experts are people that they're really the only thing they're an expert at is pretending,
mm-hmm. yeah.
but we hold them up as being experts in other right. other areas.
Right. So. Give them a voice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I know the farm bill, of course, affects all of agriculture. And how is that, or the lack of the farm bill, or, you know, the combination of all of that, how is that affecting our pork producers?
Well, the farm bill is set up to be reauthorized every 5 years. That's so we can make improvements. You know, we don't necessarily see, you know, huge change in the farm bill. It's just a you know, keeping it up with the times. And that would be the case, I think, with this farm bill and pork producers. But, you know, we have some language in there, some programs in there for foreign animal disease prevention and preparedness, and that gets more important. You know, 5 years ago when we did a farm bill, or actually 2018 when we did a farm bill, you know, African swine fever was not in our hemisphere. It is today. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we've had to up our game on that, and there's some help in there with doing that. You know, the way we market pigs changes, the way, you know, that we evaluate carcasses changes. So, you know, we've got language in there to update that so producers have a better price discovery mechanism. Trade has changed so much since 2018 and the way we handle trade. So there's some dollars in there to help with keeping foreign markets open and having access to foreign markets, which is so important. We export about 25% of the pork we raise. And, you know, so trade is very important to us. But what I like for people outside the industry to understand is, you know, the trade helps people in the U.S. because what we export is parts and pieces of the pig that we just don't enjoy here. Mm-hmm. And the value is not here. So to put it, to boil it down as simple as I can, if you want your bacon and your ribs to be affordable, you want trade. You mm-hmm. want those other pieces to go where they command a lot more value, because sure. we're just not going to eat all of what we produce.
Right. No, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to... I don't know that we haven't talked about this yet, but you are the president of the National Pork Producers Council. And so in listening to you talk, it's very clear that you're a voice not only for your farm and for your family, you are a voice for the pork industry. And it's really important that we have these types of people and folks that we'll step up into that role to be able to speak on behalf of the pork industry, not only in the state that you reside in, but the U.S. and even further than that. So just talk a little bit about your role there and what the purpose is and what you all do on that council for the pork industry.
Sure. So the National Pork Producer Council is the national organization that deals with the politics, mostly the political side. So we have two national organizations. We have the Pork Checkoff, and you know their focus is research, development, and education, and that's mandated because that's a mandatory checkoff. So we take care of everything else, which is trade, you know, policy, those types of things, and we're voluntarily funded. And so, you know, we very much appreciate the producers that are members. But we are a national organization. There's 42 states that have a Pork Producers Association, and we're a federation of those states. So really the policies come up from the states. We have a national meeting where we debate policy and pass policy, and that's what we live by at the council. But the board of directors is 16 members at this time. 14 of those are producers. We have one packer processor and one allied member as well. But the producers are the only ones that can be in the leadership roles. Mm-hmm. And we're very diverse. So we're spread out across the country and we're spread out within the industry, you know, from, you know, the size of operations, the type of operations. So a very diverse group, which is it's really interesting, you know, to be in those meetings. And you know, when a new so I'm in my seventh year on the board, so I'm kind of the old guy. There's one guy that's been there a little bit longer than me, but which is kind of funny to say. But I you know, it seems like when, you know, you get a new member on, they talk about their stay, they talk about where they come from and the needs mm-hmm. there. And very, very quickly within that first year, they're talking about the industry on a national basis. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when we come together, you know, we leave our farm behind, we leave our state behind, and we're talking about what makes sense for the industry as a whole.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so it's really neat, and that's what we focus on, and you know, freedom to operate, maintaining our cost of production, because that's key. We need to be the low cost producer in the world, yep. and then we have to stay together. We've talked about Prop 12 and Massachusetts Question 3, and what the activists have done there is. It raises our cost of production, mm-hmm. and it puts a bit of a divide in our industry. And I tell producers all the time that, you know, we'll continue to work on that cost of production piece. We'll continue to push back, and we'll continue to fight. Dividing, that's our choice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We choose to do that, and so that's on us. And that's what I really caution producers across the nation, and you know, and I get it, times are tough and people are making tough decisions and emotions run high, but we have to stay together. We have to be one voice. We're you know, that's the only way we're effective.
Yeah, that's really good advice,
and, absolutely.
You know, I hope folks kind of really listen to that, what Scott just said. Part of what I caught you talking about, or one of the questions I guess, was talking about H2A labor. And, you know, all the, as many people know, or they may not know, that a lot of pork producers use H2A labor in their industry. And, you know, where do y'all kind of fall on that? You know, what's happening there from that standpoint? Because I know pork producers really, really need those workers year round. It's just not a 9 month, like most of the H2A laborers are, kind of a 9 month deal.
Sure. You know, if you pay attention to politics at all, the one thing that we all have in common that like that is we're frustrated, right?
That's right.
No matter which side you're on, you're frustrated. Yeah. But nothing is more frustrating than this, than immigration, the border.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So labor gets lumped into that. You know, just by demographics in this country, we're losing 2,000 workers a day to retirement. So there's about 10,000 baby boomers a day retiring, and there's about 8,000 people becoming of age to work in this country, mm-hmm. every day. So we're losing 2,000 workers a day. The way we replace them is technology, labor, or do without services. And I don't know about here in Kentucky, but I know in Missouri, it's hard to find a convenience store that's open 24 hours a day.
Sure.
So we're doing without. Mm-hmm. We know there's more technology, there's more robotics, all those things. But the big piece of that is immigrants. And that's always been our immigration policy in this country. Bring in the number of workers that we need for our economy. And that's what we should be doing today. But we've got it all gets shoved together, whatever you want to call it, the border crisis, immigration, whatever. Mm-hmm. And so, but both parties have their stance, and they both win by talking about their piece of it. But the whole country loses because we can't do anything. You know, and we've been pushing for a change in the H-2A visa program because we think that's an easy fix. That, mm-hmm. should be an easy thing to do. It's really simple. It makes a lot of sense. We can't find anybody that disagrees with us, but we can't find anybody that'll do it, because they're not going to do anything until they do everything. And nobody has an appetite to do everything. So that's the frustration. You know, the TN program has been a really good program where we can bring up workers. That's a USMCA thing. So ag workers with a college education can move between the U.S., Canada, and Mexico and work. That's what there's other restrictions on the program, but that's what it was set up to do. But, you know, we're even having some issues now with the TN program, with being able to get those workers. We just have to solve that issue. And I guess maybe it takes the people rising up and saying, hey, fix this. Get off of center here, or get out of your camps and fix this.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that seems to be a struggle. It's not a new struggle. It's been a struggle, and you know, trying to find how to fix that is.
It will continue to be a struggle.
Yeah, that's a mighty big mountain that to be able to take to climb, on. But I think that we have to be diligent. We do, and I think you have to be diligent to keep on, even though you're frustrated, and these organizations are frustrated, and we appreciate and respect the folks like the council, the National Pork Producers Council and the others for continuing to fight that battle, even though it's a battle that it looks like it's going to be hard to win, but you just got to keep working and chipping away at it. And that's not an easy task, but.
No, certainly an election year even makes it worse, but unfortunately.
But you're right.
We know we need a certain amount of workers to come in, and I think everybody's in agreement that we need to know who's here. You know, those are good people for the most part. They have rural values, is what I'd like to say. You know, family's important. Certainly. Working's, you know, being a good worker is important. But we need to know who's here, why they're here. I mean, the government knows we're all here.
That's right.
Right?
They don't have any trouble finding us.
Yeah, if you're born here, they know it. So, you know, some of that stuff seems like, who disagrees with that? So why can't we at least get that much done?
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, it amazes me sometimes that so many people can agree on something, but then yet we can never get anything done about anything.
Sure.
You know, and it's pretty frustrating for people in agriculture in general, and not just the pork industry, but there's a lot of different segments of agriculture that are having the same problem, you know, and it's not just us.
And it seems to be more of an agriculture problem than some other businesses. You know, we're talking about the H-2A program, but for those that are out there that may or may not know, there's an H-2B program as well. And when you look at business and some of the other businesses, whether it's a construction trade or maybe the domestic trades through hotels and cleaning services in office buildings and whatnot in our more urban areas, a lot of those people are working on an H-2B program. Totally different set of parameters that they have to work for. And if you delve into that and learn a little bit about what those parameters are, you really see how agricultural employers who employ the H-2A migrant services are really working at a disadvantage compared to some of their H-2B counterparts.
Sure. Yeah, I'm not real familiar with the H-2A program. I haven't personally used that. But, yeah, you got to provide approved housing that's inspected. You got to, you know, there's a lot of things that you have to provide to take care of those folks, which, you know, and we all want to treat people right, you know.
Absolutely.
But that's a specific program that works really well for the employer and the employee. I know some young men that have come into the country on that program. They've working on construction crews, but they told me there was 9 of them, and they agreed when they graduated high school in Mexico that they were going to do this for 5 years. So up here 9 months for 5 years, and they would have a small farm paid for that they could raise their family on. And you know, and a couple of these guys had families. They had a couple of young kids and a wife at home that they don't see for 9 months. Mm-hmm. But that their sacrifice for that 5 years and then their family's pretty set. That's a neat story. And those are the kind of people that I think we should welcome. They're a pleasure to be around.
Absolutely.
Pleasure to work with and improving the lives down in Mexico, and that's paying dividends as well. I mean, you know, our neighbor is a more wealthy neighbor. You know? That makes sense that no matter what scale, and we're seeing that because they're buying more and more products out of the U.S.
Yep.
You know, the Mexico is our number one customer when it comes to pork. We ship more there than any place else. They really like our hams. Believe it or not, we don't eat all the hams we produce in this country. and the Mexican culture likes the texture of that meat. They don't cure it and slice it thin like we do. They like the texture of the meat for their you know, their burritos and fajitas and you know, just the diet they have. So great partners, great customers, and we need that economy to do well down there for lots of reasons.
Yeah. I had an opportunity to work with some folks that came up with the H2A program and worked in tobacco. And those guys were they used to come to my house, you know, and they would invite me down to eat lunch with them. And, I mean, just you couldn't have asked for better people to be around. I mean, you really couldn't. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were as good as anybody that I've ever worked with, wanted to be here, wanted to work. Which is a change at times from folks that actually live here, you sure. know, but they were willing to do whatever and really wanted to work and just were great people to be around, really.
And many of those folks, too, the HCA workers, I mean, I've talked to some producers over the years, and they've had the same crew come back for 20, 25 years. And it's not like it's for many, it's not a short term thing. It's like you said, it's a win-win for both sides because you're getting the labor that you need and they are being able to better themselves and better their family. And it's a positive outcome.
They certainly add value to the crops that we're producing, to the products that we're producing.
Sure.
But I think they add value to us as individuals as well, culturally. When you get to be around someone different, someone from a different area, you learn a little bit more about their background and their views and what they come through. The better understanding we have of those systems, the better off we all are. Really, the more you want to help people assimilate like that.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I had when I was working with those guys, they would tell me about their home life, and it's pretty rough, you know, growing up down there in Mexico when the cartels would be in the streets at night. You know, they would tell me, they said, well, you don't go out after a certain time because the cartels would be in the streets with machine guns. You know, and you got to feel for folks like that, and you got to have great respect for somebody that wants to leave their family, leave their country. I don't want to leave my little podunk farm, you know, and go and work somewhere else for 9 months out of the year and leave my family. You know, I wouldn't want to do that, but I've got great respect for those folks. They really do a lot of that. So
that is right.
Yeah.
As I was preparing for today's podcast, we were looking over some things, and you have been a leader on many organizations, and I appreciate again you willing to do that because we have said many times on this podcast, you know, we've encouraged our listeners and folks to get involved. We've said that many times and kind of laugh about it in a way because we say it so often. But you have really taken on a lot of leadership roles in the ag industry and to be a voice and to keep improving that. And, you know, I appreciate that, and I know many others do. And I think you're getting ready to take on a new leadership role here in a couple of months. Is that correct?
Yeah, I am. But let me go back a little bit. So my grandfather was, they called him county judges at the time, county commissioner. And that's when it was a voluntary position. He didn't get paid to do that. So and my dad and my uncle served on, you know, co-op boards and rural electric boards, rural water boards, you know, all that stuff. So I grew up with that example that, hey, you know, if we want to live in a good community, then we've got to make it that way. And I've always felt like that was important. You know, I tell people, you know, the leaders in the community pick who their kids go to school with, right? And farmers are tied to the community. They're not going to pick up their assets and move someplace else. So it's really important to have a strong community. And so I've had that example for several generations. My brother's a leader in ag groups as well, and proud to do it. But one of the things when I started the hog farm and partnered back up with my dad and uncles and my father-in-law, you know, we were all in it together. My uncle that ran the business early on, he said, Scott, he said, you get involved. He said, I don't want to do that much traveling anymore, but he said, stay involved. Don't let us fall behind. That's part of your job.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so I had full support of the family, not only support, but almost a demand that you get out there and keep us on the cutting edge. I hope that doesn't sound selfish, but that's part of what you get out of being involved. You know, as you do stay up on the latest and greatest, and you hear all these ideas, and you're able to bring them back to your farm. But I do like to serve. Yeah, and so with the changes at the farm, kind of turning things over to the next generation, and thought I would be on the farm forever. My wife and I raised our family in the house we've been in for 33 years, and purchased a different house in a different town a couple of weeks ago. So huge change. Our youngest is graduating high school this year, so we've got a lot of changes coming in our life, but we're excited about it. But yeah, our executive director at Missouri retired after 40 years. I applied for the job, and the board there in Missouri offered me the position. So I start that as soon as I end my role here with MPPC. Very excited about it. I, you know, as I looked at that position, I thought, wow, that checks a lot of boxes. I get to be an advocate for an industry I love. I get to hang around pig farmers, which is always fun. Yeah. Believe it or not, we're a fun group. And I get to dabble in politics a little bit, not too much, which is all I want, you know. Yeah. But I do enjoy politics, but I don't want too much of it. So it just checked a lot of boxes of things that I enjoy, and then on top of that, they're going to pay me to do it. So couldn't beat that. So I'm really looking forward to it. I hope I serve the industry well. I hope I serve the producers well. That's really what I want to do, and still get to participate on the national level. I look forward to working with Nikki here in Kentucky and Tennessee, as well as other state execs. That's kind of a fraternity I'm finding now. That's a kind of a tight group. Mm-hmm. So looking forward to being a part of that as well.
You know, had an opportunity to visit with Nikki a couple of times on our podcast, and she does a fantastic job, and, you know, we've really gotten to enjoy knowing her.
Absolutely.
And, you know, she's a great asset to our state for sure, and for sure to our pork producers. And, you know, I'm learning all the different things that she's involved with, being on the board here in Kentucky. And I'm, you know, I'm just kind of – it was baptism by fire yesterday or last night at the board meeting, but you know, really enjoyed and can see her leadership, and you know, hopefully moving the folks in Kentucky in a forward way, and I'm sure your folks in Missouri, you'll do the same thing. And we appreciate your leadership on the MPPC, on their board, and then as you move into your new role, we really appreciate folks like you. We need more folks like you, folks that are willing to tell their story. You know, when we always say it on this program, if we don't tell our story, somebody else will that may not tell it right. And so we appreciate the things that you've done so far.
Well, thank you.
Sounds good. You know, Scott, one of the things we always like to do towards the end of this show is we like to wrap things up with a timely tip for our listeners. That may be something production related to the time of the year. It may just be something that general that people should be doing all of the time. And today's timely tip is just that. We've talked about a lot of different things today, but one of the things we've talked about is having good communication and working closely with people in our industry. We think that it's a good time for our folks that are listening to develop a relationship with their elected officials. Whenever we have emerging issues, it's always good to have that relationship already formed and all those bonds already strengthened, so that when issues pop up, you can just start working on them and work together. So we like to encourage all of our listeners to be involved at all levels, but certainly at that level with our legislators, to be involved and to have that working relationship.
I totally agree with that, and I've seen that so many times the last few years of being on the MPPC board. Our staff, I can't say enough good things about them, but it is really about relationships. You know, when things start going south, if you know somebody, you can call. Mm-hmm. As a congressman, Ike Skelton used to say for Missouri, I don't have to know everybody, but I better know somebody that knows somebody.
That's good.
So, yeah, if you just have somebody that can get you in the door, that's so very important, because, you know, you start off with a level of trust and a level of respect. And when the fire is happening, it's the wrong time to build trust and build respect. If you have that up front, then you're ready to go.
That's right.
Great advice.
That's right.
Absolutely. Well, Scott, we appreciate you being here with us today. We're going to let you get on to the rest of your doings. I know you've got to get out of here before too awful long. So we want to thank you for this week's information, and thanks to our listeners for joining in. We hope you've enjoyed our show, and we'll make plans to join us again next week for our next episode. And until then, remember, Kentucky Ag matters.